I was already away, the coin soaring once more. This time, when I caught it, it was directly in front of Rory's nose. "Your turn, Mendacious," I said, breathless. "Hit me as hard as you can." I flickered away. "If you can." The chase began. Maud, Rory, Benji, even the gargoyle, though he hid his eyes behind his hand half the time, tried to tag me before I could flicker away with the coin. Sometimes I did not catch the coin, and they caught me. Benji managed a few swipes at my back, my hair, but he was slow, easy to dodge. Not like Maud, and certainly not like Rory. The yard was a game board, and he was always a move ahead. Even when I threw the coin in a direction I supposed out of reach, he was already running, already reaching out, already catching me. Long and limber and bereft of armor, Rory kept his knees bent, his eyes tight in concentration, and his feet fast. By the 10th, maybe the 20th time he'd caught me, I was seething, and Rory looking dangerously close to having a good time. "Good. You're mad." He turned the coin over in my palm. "Time to break things." Maud and the gargoyle and Rory hauled stones, discarded wood, anything that wouldn't be missed, onto the upland. This time, I threw the coin rough side up and shattered them. The gargoyle clapped. They made a square of sticks, mimicking the pool in the Ardent Oarsman's Hall. I practiced around it, never getting too close. "Draw him away from his pool," Rory instructed. "Deny his awe, its magic, its advantage. Stay away from water, and he will be but a man with a stone oar." But for every hour we trained, for every time the coin grazed stone or wood but did not shatter it, the lines in Maud's face deepened. By night, I was a shell of a human. I wobbled to the inn, ate with the other knights, but was so close to using my dinner plate as a pillow that the gargoyle took me from the commons, brought me to our room, tossed me into bed. I was asleep in seconds. When I woke, the moon was still a visitor in my window. The gargoyle was snoring next to my bed, a blanket thrown over himself. Maud's bed was empty. That's when I heard the voices, just outside the door. "What, Maud?" It was Rory, snapping. "Just spit it out." I tiptoed to the door. On the other side, someone let out a low sigh. "I already told you, 3 days is not enough time to prepare." Maud's voice was hard, steadfast. "It should be you or I facing the oarsman." "You think I don't know that?" Rory's voice became perilously soft. "You think I want a single scratch upon her?"
"If the oarsman challenged her, then we should honor that," another voice said, softer than the others. "Benji, we should do things the proper way."
"The artful brigand was cruel but idle," Maud bit back, "and the harried scribe was too enamored with his own wit to put up much of a fight. The ardent oarsman is the omen of strength. He will be ruthless. Six has been stuck behind a wall for years. If we do things the proper way, this omen could kill her." My throat tightened.
"Surely she knows that," Benji said. "Dying, after all, is the risk of killing."
"You say that, Benji, and you said it easily, because you know Rory and I will do your killing for you. We swore to it, but Six did not. She's never killed anything or anyone.
And I fear..."
Maud's voice became uncharacteristically rough.
"I fear she will die without ever having lived."
I flinched, as if struck. "Maud," Benji said gently. Another sigh sounded. Then, Rory spoke, hard and sure.
"She can beat the oarsman. I don't have a single doubt."
Footsteps echoed, closer to my door. I withdrew, and the latch turned. When Maud stepped into the room, head low,
Her eyes widened over me, sitting upright on my bed. "You're awake?" I nodded. I could see in her eyes that she knew I'd overheard them. She opened her mouth to say something, but words never came. Maud undressed, got in bed, and I pulled my blankets over my ears and faced the wall, thinking on dying and killing and living, and how I was unsuited for all three. For two more days, dawn to dusk, the steps repeated. I woke, moved my feet up the lookout staircase, then back down to our makeshift training ground. Rory used the coin, appearing and disappearing, and Benji did the same with the Harrod Scribe's inkwell. I tried to anticipate them, to kick or hit, or say something sharp to get them to hold still long enough for me to knock them over. Then it was my turn with the coin. I practiced smooth side up, disappearing and reappearing around the makeshift square, while Rory, Benji, and the gargoyle tried to catch me. Then rough side up, breaking things, while visualizing the ardent oarsman's legs, his arms, shoulders or knees. Anything I might break to get him to yield. And I did. For the diviners, I hit every single mark. It was only when I thought of what Maud had said, though she kept silent now, that I erred. When my foot slipped on the stairs, when I dropped the coin or missed its target. Maud, and the words she'd dealt. She will die without ever having lived. And then it was nightfall of the third day, and there was no more time to train, and no more time to prepare, and hardly any to live. I couldn't sleep. The gargoyle was snoring, and so was Maud. She'd come into the room an hour ago, undressed, turned to me, opened her mouth, shut it, and turned to the wall to sleep. I sat upon the windowsill and looked out. Gentle, the night. Gone was the storm, the torrid rain and hail that had ripped through the peaks the last 2 days. The clouds were vanquished, and the sky was that romantic shade between violet and black and sapphire, the wind a susurrant noise. I could hear owls, and farther, the lull of the tenor. I wondered if the ardent oarsman had something to do with it. The magic stone objects were all transportive and destructive. Maybe he had caused the storm somehow, and had now taken it away, lulling me into a false sense of ease.
"Mouse in my ear,"
the gargoyle murmured, twitching in his sleep.
"Bartholomew, water the tulips before they bite."
I caught myself smiling at him. Oh, to be a gargoyle. A shy knock sounded on the door. I opened it a crack. "Lost, Mendacious. You're awake." Rory stood in the dim light of the corridor, wearing a loose tunic and leathers, dark hair strewn over his brow. He seemed surprised to see me. "I thought diviners were good at sleeping." "If you're looking for Maud, she's long abed." "I'm looking for you." He was getting better at finding my gaze through my shroud. He rolled his eyes. For once, the gesture seemed directed at himself. "I wasn't trying to wake you." "I wasn't asleep." I stepped into the corridor and shut the door behind me. "Can't, actually." His gaze dipped. I wasn't wearing anything but a pale nightshirt. Rory was antsier than usual. Bright in the cheeks, shoulders tight, hand-moving invisible puppets in his pocket. "There's a place," he murmured. "Not far. It'll help with the restlessness."
"Will I need my shoes?"
Finally, a smile. He tried to hide it, biting down on his bottom lip, but he was a poor actor. The entirety of his body eased. "Not this time." Chapter 19. I Can't Swim. We left the inn, saying nothing as we wound our way through the darkened village and down the road. The crescent moon was high in the sky, holding water, dropping a shaving of silver light over everything it touched. I looked out over the vantage, the cloudlessness affording me a view through the mountains. Beyond, I could see the waters of the Tenor, the rolling fields of Traum. But no matter how hard I squinted, I could not see Aisling.
There's a spot at the base of that.
Rory pointed a finger up at the nearest looming peak.
Hot springs, hot enough to ease some of the aches your muscles are undoubtedly feeling after 3 days of hauling ass.
I stopped mid-step. My muscles are fine.
Mine aren't. Rory chuckled. It's grueling work, getting you into fighting shape.
He turned, noted my stillness.
That's a bad joke, Diviner. You're ready for tomorrow.
That's not why... My cheeks burned. Don't laugh. The echoes of his chuckle still lingered in the air.
I've never laughed in my life.
The breeze picked up, reaching its fingers into my clothes, goading a confession. I can't swim. He surprised me with the gift of silence. And it was a gift, because I didn't want to say out loud that it would have been as arbitrary as everything else that happened at Aisling Cathedral, teaching a girl intended to drown how to swim. Perhaps he already understood that, and the silence was for both of us to put that ugly truth somewhere private. All Rory did, in his usual half-hearted way, was shrug.
That's no trouble.
I expected the hot springs to smell of rotting flowers. They didn't. They smelled of earth. Hidden in the shadow of the mountains, steam rising off them like tired old ghosts, sat a cluster of pools. Rory led me to the largest. I was about to ask him if he'd come here many times before, when he reached down, gripped the hem of his tunic, yanked it over his head. My gaze followed where muscles cusped his spine, then moved to the two small dimples just above the rim of his pants. I hadn't seen him bare like that since his first night at Aisling, back when I thought him the foulest knight in all of Traum. And maybe he still was, because Rory was currently flinging off his boots and reaching for the leather clasp around his pants, tugging it. What the hell are you doing? He peered over his shoulder. Whatever he saw on my face, the panic, the heat, made him smile.
Feel free to avert your virtuous eyes.
His pants hit the ground. Water splashed, steam billowed, and then all I could see of Rory was his head, his neck, the lines of his clavicle peeking out of the hot spring. He stretched his arms over his head and let out a moan that made me bite down.
Good for what ails you.
He fixed me in his gaze, twirled his hands and bowed exaggeratedly.
Wouldst the lady join me?
Why are you so annoying?
Why are you afraid to get in? I am standing in the deepest point. No swimming required.
His eyes flitted over my nightshirt.
If it's about protecting my innocence, you're too late. You were practically naked in that wet divining robe the night we met.
How mortifying for you. He slapped a hand over his eyes and turned around, proffering me privacy and another view of his sculpted back.
Never said that.
I thought of Bold Four. How, if she were here, she'd already be naked, and the other diviners would inevitably follow. Two, grumbling, three and five, half timid, half excited, and one sighing as she held her arm out to me.
Come on, she'd say. Someone has to mind them.
Loneliness touched everything, and the aching beauty of the peaks, the pools, the incomparable night sky made it so much worse. I put a hand to my heart, to the five invisible cracks that lived there, and began to unbutton my shirt. It fell to the ground, pooling around my bare feet. Next off were my undergarments, and then I was exhaling shakily, crossing my arms over my breasts, thighs pressing together, naked, under the silver moon. Rory kept his back to me, shoulders tightening. The pool was warm, as if it had its own feverish heart, working faster than mine. I waded into the ripples until I wore the water like a new dress. You can turn around now. He waited a breath. When Rory faced me, the derision I'd come to know him by was absent, the lines of his brow smoothed, eyelids almost heavy.
You're nervous.
I flicked water in his face and rolled my shoulders and, damn it, he was right. The water was good for what ailed me, a balm over aching muscles. I rubbed my neck, let my head fall back.
Where are you sore?
Rory lifted an accusatory finger out of the water.
Don't bother denying it. How's the wrist?
I could toss the Artful Brigand's coin with both hands, but never perfectly with my left. So I'd spent the last 3 days using my right, resulting in an ache in the joint that never seemed to quiet. It's fine. He gave me a champion sneer, and I laughed. It aches, a little.
Not half as much as that confession, I'll wager.
He drifted closer, closer, until he was an arm's length away.
May I?
Everything was languid, slow, as if night itself had dipped its long finger in the pool and stirred the water backward. I held out my arm, and Rory took my wrist with such startling care, I exhaled sharply. His gaze rose, and it was impossible to tell with eyes already so dark, but his pupils seemed to widen over me. Then his fingers were moving, pressing, intricate and purposeful, over the soreness of my wrist. I let out a heavy noise, and Rory nodded, like he understood the language of pain and reprieve.
Is this all right?
Just a whisper. Yes. Lines drew between his eyes. Rory took to my muscles with honed precision, firm fingers, insistent but never prodding, like it was important to him, a craft to do well. Just like when he had measured me for armor, I studied him, ran my gaze down his face, neck, chest. I wondered if his ribs were still bruised. What about you? I reached out, drew a finger up his side. Are you still in pain?
He shivered. Near you? Always.
Your ribs, you idiot. From getting caught stealing Ashling's spring water.
That. It still aches. A little.
I frowned, thinking of him in pain. Of him, thieving as a boy. We'd both been foundling children, both taken under the wings of omens, the Abbess and the Artful Brigand. But where the Abbess had put me in gossamer and made me exceptional, Rory had endured the opposite. And it seemed so impossible he should have come to know Benji's grandfather, met Maud, become a knight, and that I had purposely chosen the short straw that day, lingered along the Ashling wall, looked down, seen him. I was losing my faith in everything, but the two of us meeting, it felt almost divine. What was it like? I asked, killing the Artful Brigand.
Years in the making, and over in a moment.
His fingers moved up to my forearm. Again, he asked,
may I?
He waited at the gate of every place he touched until I granted him entry. And as Rory soothed the muscles he'd helped make sore, I wondered if I should tell him I did not always think him so unknightly, that his unwavering belief in me during our training had not gone unnoticed, that I had not detected an ounce of Maud's skepticism in him, as if he already knew the outcome of my fight with the oarsmen. Not because of dreams or portents, and not because it was a fantastical story he told himself. He simply believed I could win. Errant knight Roderick Mendacious, prideful, disdainful, godless, believed in me. The charcoal around his eyes had been rubbed away, his black hair dropping trails of water down his clavicle, his chest.
"How are your feet?" he asked. "Can't be easy, wearing those fine boots day in, day out."
"You touch my feet, you die." A wicked smile unraveled over his mouth. Rory snatched a hand under the water. I drew back, kicking to the surface, splashing him. He laughed. When I aimed another kick, he caught my ankle, pulled. I slipped. I spread my arms, but the water was without pity, giving me nothing to cling to. I fell backward, and suddenly it was not a hot spring I was falling into, but the spring at Ashling Cathedral, pressed down by the abbess, opening my mouth, taking putrid water into my lungs, waiting for pain, for dreams, for stone objects, and the terrifying presence of the omens. A hand found the back of my neck. I was thrust out of the water.
"I've got you. Breathe, diviner."
I hauled in air. When I opened my eyes, I expected to see the rose window high in Ashling's cloister, but all I saw was the moon, hovering in its dark heaven. The moon and Rory.
"I didn't think."
He pushed my hair out of my face, careful of my shroud, and kept his hand at the nape of my neck as my feet found the rocks at the bottom of the pool. I coughed.
"It's fine. It's not lost on me how terrible I've been, growing up under the artful brigand."
He said it in a gasping rush, like it was he who'd been underwater.
"I'm discourteous and utterly poisoned by contempt. I know that."
His throat hitched. "And I don't know how to behave around you. You make me so fucking nervous.
But letting you fall underwater, when all you ever did at Ashling was drown, I..."
"Mendacious." I reached up, put a hand over his mouth. "It was an accident." He nodded too fast and wouldn't look at me. My hand slid to his cheek. "Rory." Silver moonlight painted his hair, his nose, the lines of his brow, and when Rory glanced down, I saw a misery in his eyes.
"I'm sorry," he mouthed.
And just like that, another crack fissured in my heart.
"We should go back," he said, after a drawn silence. "You need your rest for tomorrow."
"Not yet. Can you..." I didn't want it to end like that. Him riddled with guilt, me thinking of drowning. "My right shoulder," I managed. "It's a little sore." His focus drifted down my neck. Slowly, he reached for my shoulder. I relaxed into his touch and let my head fall back. I looked up at the sky, the thousands of stars stitched upon a vast purple tapestry, reveling in the sensation of being held up in water and not pressed down.
"Your hair is pretty," Rory murmured, "like moonlight, and your skin is so soft. But beneath..."
He needed my muscle.
"If I were to bite down, I'd break my teeth on you."
"If you were to bite down," I said to the sky, "your bottom teeth would leave a crooked mark, unique as your fingerprint." Rory's hand stilled. A flush rolled onto my face. "That's what I thought when we first spoke at Ashling," I muttered, "outside the diviner's cottage. You smiled." He looked half amused, half something else.
"And you were imagining what pattern my teeth might leave on your skin."
I was in the throes of the Idleweed, out of my senses.
"Mm-hmm."
He resumed his ministrations.
"Shall we see then?"
I wondered if he could feel my pulse, drumming through the water. "Where would you bite me, knight?"
"Wherever you told me to, diviner."
"My arms, my neck, my mouth, stomach, breasts." And maybe he knew, because his breath quickened, like he, too, was thinking of all the parts of me he might sink his teeth into. I lifted my palm to his lips, just as thousands of palms had been lifted to mine during divinations. Only now there was no viscous blood to swallow, just moonlight over a sheen of water. Rory held my gaze and slipped his teeth over the flesh below my thumb. Pressed down. My lips parted. His bite was the same as his touch, exacting but gentle, a low, determined pressure. Then his teeth were gone. Rory shut his eyes, sighed into my palm, replaced his teeth with his lips. Rory kissed the place he'd bitten with arduous slowness.
"I'd rather this left a mark instead," he murmured into my skin.
He was a thief, stealing my breath, my reason. "May I ask something of you?" He looked up. "If tomorrow does not go well, will you find a home for the gargoyle? Will you keep looking for the diviners?" His grip on my hand tightened.
"If you have imagined portents, let me dispel them. The only thing that matters in this world is the effort you exact, diviner. And you have been working harder than anyone I've known. So please, don't look to dreams, and don't look for signs. Just look forward. Tomorrow will go well."
"Two things can be true at once, Mendacious. I can look forward, work hard, I labored over the word, and still die. So I'm asking you, will you find a home for the gargoyle? Will you keep looking for the diviners?"
"Yes."
He drew closer, water sloshing around us, and I was aware of his body, mine, and the bareness of them beneath the spring's surface.
"The thing is, I think I'd do anything you asked of me."
And then he was pulling away, moving farther into the pool, leaving me tangled in the beat of my own heart.
"Try to get some sleep. I'll see you in the morning."
I remained unmoving, 10 seconds, 20. When Rory turned to give me privacy, I lifted myself out of the pool, found my nightshirt, threw it haphazardly over myself, and glanced back at him. "Aren't you coming?"
"I need a minute."
I wandered back to the village. The mountainous earth was chill beneath my feet, and the tenor sang its distant, watery song. I stopped to listen, noted how the moon had journeyed in the sky, how the wind through brome and heather was a delicate whisper. And it startled me that the loneliness I'd felt earlier was no longer so oppressive, as if put to sleep. The night was half gone, and though I needed rest, I could not bring myself to mind that I was awake and out of bed. Everything was just so beautiful. I looked down at my hand. The marks from Rory's teeth were still there. I'd been right. The bottom row looked like a crooked, crowded line of soldiers, unique as a fingerprint, as a line of stars. I lifted my palm, put it to my mouth, ran my lips over the indents. Maud and the gargoyle were still snoring when I returned to the inn. When I slept, I didn't dream of Ashling Cathedral's looming edifice, or diviners swathed in gossamer. I didn't even dream of the ardent oarsman. I dreamed of a knight with gold in his ears and charcoal around his eyes, who did all the ignoble things I asked of him. Maud was up with the dawn, abrupt as the thundering sky.
"It's time."
The gargoyle waltzed around our small chamber, humming a tune. I sat up in bed, rubbed my shrouded eyes. "What has you so pleased?"
"Bartholomew suggested I act as your squire, since you have none."
"My..." Maud stepped back, revealing a pile of armour at the foot of my bed. Her armour.
"It won't be an exact fit," she said. "Not as effective as the one being made, but more protective than your leathers or chainmail alone. You're strong enough to bear it."
Maud's armour was intricate, swirls that resembled billowing boughs engraved in the breastplate.
"It was my mother's," she said, "and hers before."
A lump formed in my throat. "You realize if I die, you'll likely lose it."
"Thought about that. Figured out a solution."
Maud hauled me off the bed, surprised me with a fearsome hug.
"Live."
The gargoyle's stone fingers were blunt and clumsy, mostly because he was trilling with excitement.
"Me, a squire."
He held up chainmail, fastened armour to my legs, my arms, snapped Maud's breastplate over my chest.
Would you wear the helmet, Bartholomew?
Yes, Maud answered for me. The gargoyle handed it over, like he'd once handed me my divining robe, and I tucked it under my arm. I'm ready. The inn was dark. None of the other knights had risen, oblivious of their king's absence. But there were fishermen, nets on their backs, moving in droves down the mountain to cast in lower parts of the tenor. I spotted Hamelin's mother and a few of the other nobles among them. They watched us as we passed, nodded, their gazes keen and curious and reverent as we disappeared into the mountains. Rory and Benji were waiting on the other side of the plateau, armor clad. When they saw me, fitted in the same attire as them, they both went still. Benji whistled.
You're a proper knight, Six.
Rory's eyes were fast, measuring the scope of me. When he saw Maud's helmet tucked under my arm, he gave me a pointed look. I'll wear it, I muttered. He approached.
And this?
He tucked an errant strand of hair behind my ear, brushing my shroud. I'll wear it too. He gave me his fist, unfurled his fingers, handed me the artful brigand's coin.
Let's go kill an omen.
We made it up the mountain the same way we had before, carried up and over the waterfall in turns by the gargoyle. He did not complain this time. He was still too heartened to be considered my squire, which, I was beginning to suspect, he considered a more essential role than knight. First with Rory and me, then with Maud and Benji, he spread his stone wings and flew us skyward into a gale. We landed at the ardent oarsman's castle. The shale sprites were not on the stairs this time, but we tiptoed up the steps just the same. Knocked upon the ancient door. Waited. There was no answer. Rory slammed his open palm against groaning wood, but no matter his hails, the ardent oarsman did not come.
Perhaps he went on a sabbatical, the gargoyle offered.
He peered up at the tempestuous sky.
And not a moment too soon.
Well then, Benji stepped back. Let's invite ourselves in. He rolled his shoulders and sprang forward, crashing full force into the castle door. It burst open in a cloud of dust.
That's the spirit, Your Majesty.
Rory hauled Benji to his feet, and Maud led us, axe in hand, into the castle just as the sky opened up. The clatter of rain upon the roof was like a thousand tapping fingers, muffling the sound of our footsteps. Still, I felt obtrusive in armor, too loud, an unwelcome guest. But the dark corners of the oarsman's castle, full of hungry shadows, held no one who might admonish me. Not in corridors, not in the great Spartan chambers, not even sprites stirred to see us. There was simply no one there.
What the hell?
We stood in the great hall, near the ardent oarsman's pool and a great pile of coins. Benji stared at the money, then rubbed his hands over his eyes and blinked repeatedly, as if willing the omen to appear.
What sort of game is this?
Wind and rain flew through the open east wall, spraying us.
I don't understand.
Stone crunched beneath my boot. It's been 3 days. Where is he?
There.
Rory stood near one of the columns, wind in his face. Looking out, we crowded around him, and I was afforded a view of the silver-blue basin behind the castle, the crystalline water that fed the Tenor River. Fixed in the center of the basin was a platform, a broad wooden square, and upon it, hood back, jagged hands rested upon his oar, the ardent oarsman, looking out at us with unblinking stone eyes. Waiting.
There, Benji said, incredulous.
He wants to fight her there.
Why wouldn't he? Maud's face was drawn. He's got his oar. He can drop it in the water at any moment, spin circles around her. He'll shake the platform, break her aim. One misstep, and the artful brigand's coin is going in the drink, and six along with it. She turned to me. I hope you're a damn strong swimmer. Rory went white. Last night, the hot spring in me, slipping beneath its water, unveiling over his face.
It is not like me to be the bearer of bad tidings, the gargoyle said. Bartholomew does not know how to swim. But worry not.
He looked up at me, smiled proudly.
She has always excelled at drowning.
Chapter 20. With Hammer, with Chisel. Benji and Maud had joined Rory in a suspended state, staring, mouths agape, dread wafting off them like smoke. What do you mean she can't swim?
As I said, the gargoyle remarked, she is excellent at dr-
Outside of Ashling, it is not a good thing to know how to drown. Maud's shout echoed through the hall. It is a very bad thing. The gargoyle recoiled, eyes wide, bottom lip quivering. He let out a terrible sob, turned to the open wall, vaulted past the columns, and took flight. I called after him, but my voice was swallowed by the oncoming storm. I glowered over my shoulder. Don't yell at him. He'll survive, Maud said. You, however. Maud. Benji so rarely raised his voice, so rarely tended anything unpleasant. But now, hands locked in knots, I noted a tear in the visage of his good nature, a temper lingering beneath.
You put your armor on her, he snapped. Now it's time to put on your faith.
He turned to Rory, anger still fixed on his face. She can't use the coin. The inkwell either. If they're lost in that water, we'll never get them back. Rory stood in the heart of the hollow room, and for once did not fidget. His focus was tethered entirely to me.
It's up to her.
It was armor, only armor, that held me up. I can move my feet, keep my balance, even if that platform quakes. I looked down at the coin in my hand. But if I throw this, miss even once... There was a voice in the storm, a low, horrible rasp riding the wind.
Where is the diviner who thinks me nothing without her? Where is the diviner come to defeat me at my craft?
Then louder, as if echoing in the walls of my head,
where is the diviner come to me for answers?
I felt like a dreaming child, fallen and shattered within the mountain peaks, trembling. If I glanced up, I could almost imagine I saw Ashling Cathedral's reaching vaults, where I'd spent my entire life believing in the story of the omens. But as I looked at the ardent oarsman, I felt my armor around me, so much heavier than gossamer, rooting me to the earth. This was not a dream. And he was not a god. The abbess's story was fissuring, and I would help break it. I handed Rory back his coin and stepped through the columns into the rain. The others called after me, but did not catch me until I was already standing upon the lip of the basin, facing the omen that waited. There was a boat, small and wooden, a chain attached to its bow. The chain disappeared into water, then resurfaced upon the ardent oarsman's platform. He reached down, took it in his fist, nodded at the boat. Maud caught me before I could get in. You need a weapon. A weight slid into my hand. I didn't have to look down to know it was her battle axe. I do have faith in you, she said. I think you would do anything for your diviners. Even... Her voice was drowned out by a new gust of wind. I looked up.
Against the rolling grey sky, a dark shape appeared, getting closer and closer. A voice, singing out of tune. The gargoyle was back. He landed with a huff, sticking his nose up at Rory and Benji, and Maud in particular. But when he reached me, all haughtiness vanished. He looked up with an open face. In his hands, resting in the beds of his palms, my hammer and chisel.
"It is important for a squire to carry a knight's weapons," he said,
the words so stoic, I wondered if he'd practiced them on the flight back.
"I will carry them for you, Bartholomew. I will shoulder any weight you give me."
Oh, I thought, a great swelling in my chest. To be a gargoyle. To be my gargoyle. I set Maud's axe down, picked up the hammer and chisel. They bore no magic like the stone objects the omens carried, but their weight was familiar, the feel of them in my palms assuring. With them, I felt strong. The ardent oarsman pointed a gnarled hand at the boat. "That's your ride," Benji said, coming up next to me. "No turning back now." "She's not turning back." Maud stood at my other side, wrapping a knuckle over my breastplate. "I want this returned without a scratch." They both stepped aside, but not before Maud offered the gargoyle her hand in apology. He didn't take it. And then there was a deep voice in my ear, a steadfast presence at my back.
"Nervous, diviner?"
"No," I said in a rush. "Then, tell me..." I swallowed.
"Tell you."
The warmth in Rory's voice was dissonant against the sound of rain, pinging over our armor. He rounded my body, blocking my view of the ardent oarsman, and pulled Maud's helmet from the crook of my arm.
"What?"
"It's stupid."
"Then it should come easily to me."
I bit down on a smile. "The diviners asked for stories, when we were sick or tired or afraid, to calm us."
"You want me to tell you a story?"
He placed the helmet on my head, over my shroud. His voice, trapped within the iron, hummed in my ears.
"Once, there was a foundling boy who didn't believe in anything. He grew up, became a worldly knight, and still he struggled to believe. He bore hardly any hope and a mountain of disdain, and that should have been the end."
He took my hand, squeezed it, tightening my hold on my hammer.
"But then he came to a cathedral upon a tour and met a woman there, and all the tales he'd troubled himself with about cruelty, about unfairness and godlessness, he started to forget. He was afforded another chance, as if by magic, to believe in something. He'd never be a very good knight, but every time he looked at the woman, he had the distinct faith, his eyes roved my face, that things could be better than they'd been.
I'd fallen through the seams of time, into a place where there were no omens or stone, no armor, no gossamer. There was just Rory, me, and a strange sacrality between us. He lowered the visor of my helmet.
"Can you still see?"
"Yes."
"Good. If you fall in that water, I'm coming in after you."
I stepped around him, faced the basin, the omen, but looked back to Rory. "It's a good story, Mendacious. I liked it." He held me in his gaze like he needed to.
"Do you want to know how it ends?"
"Does it end?" He nodded.
"It ends a handful of minutes from now. After you've won, and there is one less omen in the world."
He grinned.
"It ends when you kiss me."
"You mean it ends after I've won, and there is one less omen in the world, and I hit you as hard as I can?"
"With your mouth."
I withdrew, tucking away my grin. When I faced the basin again, it was my spine, not my armor, holding me up. I stepped into the boat. The oarsman was on his platform, watching. When I got into his boat, he took the chain in both hands and began to yank. The water began to churn, the omen pulling the boat, and me within it, toward his platform. I wanted to look back, at the gargoyle, and Benji, and Maud, at Rory. I wanted to see the assuredness in their gazes, but all I saw, when the boat scraped against the side of the platform, and the ardent oarsman offered me a gnarled hand, were cold, stone eyes. I ignored his hand, hauling myself up and moving to the opposite side of the platform, widening the space between us, ever wary of the water waiting just over the wooden lip. The oarsman surveyed me beneath his hood and smiled that toothy, jagged smile. He lifted his oar, pointed it at me like a threat, then swung it outward. His voice boomed over the water.
Any intervention on the diviner's behalf shall render the challenge lost and her life forfeit. No gargoyle, no king, no knight shall come to her aid.
His smile widened.
Agreed?
I allowed myself a glance at the shore. The others were there, hands on their weapons, feet practically in the water. Watching with such furious intensity, they had the effect of an army awaiting the war call. And Rory, his face was remade by hate. His black hair caught the wind, painting him wraith-like, a dark smudge in the storm. Maud came up next to him, and Benji as well, Rory and he holding out their stolen objects, the harried scribe's inkwell, the artful brigand's coin, like they were the severed heads of their enemies. The oarsman's knuckles cracked as he strangled the neck of his oar. He pivoted, pointing that oar once more at me.
You little fool.
He made a low, horrible noise.
This will be the end of you.
I kept my jaw hewn shut. His stone eyes fell to my hammer.
What will you do? Crack my skull? Do you imagine the truth of your lost diviners will fall like blood from my brow?
The platform groaned as he took a step forward.
They are to the wind, consumed by this starving world. You should not have come here.
He dipped the blade of his oar over the side of the platform.
But I'm very glad you have.
The water around the basin erupted. Two waves rose, crashing down on me like cantering horses, dropping me to my knees. I gasped, braced myself. The wind picked up, a ripping force, and the rain hardened to hail. I understood then the full magic within the omen's oar. When he dipped the handle into the water, the magic transported him. When he dipped the blade of the oar in, it became a staff of destruction, the water itself bending to his will. He stirred it, calling forth waves that crashed over the platform, splashing me, making me fall. I tried to stand, was knocked down by another wave. The platform tilted, and I rolled to the lip. The oarsman suddenly on top of me. I rolled again, and his oar crashed just shy of where my head had been. I heard voices on the wind. I was too busy trying to hold my hammer and chisel, too busy trying to hold myself from toppling over the edge of the platform to heed them. The first time the oar struck me was in the chest. Wind screamed out of my lungs. I faltered, gasped. The second hit was just below the rim of my helmet, right along the jaw. So hard, I fell onto my back and saw stars. The voices on the wind were louder.
Six! Bartholomew! Move your feet!
Waterlogged, heavy in my armor, I dragged myself up. The oarsman made a low, mocking noise and swung once more. My hammer met his oar, the crash rivaling thunder. The reverberation sent us both back a step, fleeting surprise slackening the oarsman's glare. He withdrew his oar, showed me his teeth. I struck again, and he did not block in time. My hammer hit his leg, exactly where I'd stabbed him with my chisel 3 days ago. The omen bellowed, and then he was coming full force, oar in the water, appearing and disappearing and shaking the platform, giving his all to put me once more upon my knees. Every movement I tended, every breath, was spent defending my stance, my body. I met oar with hammer, kept my balance, tried not to slip. But it wasn't enough. The oarsman vanished over water, then reappeared right before me. There was a sharp ring, a horrible pain as the oar crashed full force into my left hip. I clattered belly down onto the platform, waves pummeling over me, filling my mouth with water. I was gasping, choking, trying to haul in air. The oarsman stalked toward me.
How easily you fall.
His steps shook the platform.
You believe it is me who is nothing. Look at yourself, diviner, a child in armor, an insect next to a god.
He wrenched me up by the back of the neck, tore at my armor with bruising fingers.
Your conviction in yourself is profane.
He was gasping, ripping away my pauldron and exposing my shoulder, the curve of my neck.
You disgust me.
He sank his teeth into my skin. I screamed. Out on the shore, four figures were a dark blur, a mess of limbs, tangling, struggling. Not against the storm, but one another. Benji, holding back the gargoyle. Maud, holding back Rory. The oarsman made a low noise of pleasure in my ear.
Yes.
He ran his tongue over the bite in my neck, lapping up blood.
You've swallowed so much more of Ashling's water than the other one. I can practically taste the spring.
Another scream ripped up my throat. I bared my teeth against excruciating pain and slammed the back of my head into the omen's face. He staggered back, grasping his oar for support. His face was painted with my blood, and so were his teeth. He opened his mouth, let out a vicious shout that came back a bellow, a chorus and fury over the water.
What other one?
I was wet, trembling, blood in my mouth, just like a divination.
You've seen another diviner?
She came as they always do, utterly still.
The omen came closer, his steps crashing over the platform.
Every 10 years they come.
He took another step.
It's the only spring water I'm given, their blood.
Another step.
I have my strength to keep up, my hunger to sate, and so,
he was upon me now,
I take my fill.
His oar collided with the side of my face. Maud's helmet was knocked clean off my head. With it came a desperate, ripping sound, a sensation of wetness, like skin sloughing off. I raised a hand to my eyes, but not fast enough. My shroud tore away, caught the vicious wind, disappeared into the storm. The ruination upon the ardent oarsman's brow froze. Stone eyes wide, mouth a jagged, bloody hole, he gazed at my unshrouded eyes so intently, it seemed to cast him into a dream. A fleeting, utter stillness. It was enough. I sprang forward. I had no oar, no inkwell, no coin, but I was across the platform in a flash. The oarsman let out a rasping shriek, swung his oar. I ducked, kept going. My vision was blurry, blotted out by rain and blood and the bruises that were already swelling around my eyes, but I kept going. When we collided, the ardent oarsman and I, the clamour was of two undeterred forces, a seismic crash. He fell back onto his platform, and I landed on top of him. He prodded me with the blunt end of his oar, but I was already pressing my chisel over his chest. He thrashed, frothing as he hit me again and again. But I raised my hammer, harnessed all the strength I possessed, and struck it directly into the omen's heart. His cry filled the air, a violent calamity that echoed through the peaks. The oarsman looked down at his body, at my chisel protruding from his chest. Blood oozed, seeping from his clothes onto wood, dripping through the platform's slats into crystalline water. I lay over his body. "I have defeated you at your craft, ardent oarsman, matched your strength and overcome it." Blood, like the rain, streamed down my face. "Where is the diviner that was brought to you?" His grip on his oar tightened, but he did not lift it. "Your eyes." He peered down at himself, at all his blood staining the basin's water. "I did not know this could happen. I did not think I would ever die." Rage, revulsion, and the unspooling terror that he hadn't been lying, that he'd sunk his teeth into past diviners, it did something wretched to me. "Tell me the truth." My gauntlets crashed into the omen's jagged body, hitting, breaking, again and again, until my hands were screaming, "Where is the diviner?" "I already told you. She came barely a week ago, naked and still. I took her into my castle, placed her upon my throne." The omen's breaths grew shallow, and drank her. When he looked at me one last time, his stone eyes held nothing. "Dead. Your diviners are all dead." A terrible gasp fled his mouth. "And so are you." He slammed his oar into the platform. There was a terrible creak, wood splintering into a thousand pieces beneath me. I lost my balance, held to my hammer and chisel, rolled, then fell into water. The Chiming Wood. Chime. Hearken to the chime in the wood. There, the wind tells us how to feel what we cannot see. Only the wind can say what is to come. Chapter 21. Sybil Delling. Diviners moved around me, twirling under a watchful moon. They danced upon the world's grassy tongue, spinning until they were airborne. Pale wings blossomed from their gossamer gowns, like petals. They flew away. I tried to follow, but my feet were pulling me down. The diviners giggled like sprites in a glen, floating farther away until they were white specks, like stars, upon a violet-blue sky. I walked alone to Ashling Cathedral. Inside, the abbess waited, a shroud in her hands. "Well," she said, "how do you feel?" "I don't know." I looked down at myself. I was naked. "Strange." "You are. Sybil Delling is dead. What remains is strange. Special." The abbess beckoned me forward. She tied the shroud around my eyes, then took my shoulders, hugged me. "And new." She shoved me into the spring. Water drew over me like the lid of a coffin. The abbess dipped her hand into the spring, grasped my throat, and pressed. I cried out, bubbles filling the water. I clawed, thrashed, and was kept down, pressed and pressed, and pressed.
Benji, bring her here!
I heard voices, not low and steady like the abbess's, but loud, rough, desperate.
Get her out of the fucking armor! It's bent! I can't...
Pith, she's blue. Someone was crying, long, aching sobs.
Bartholomew! Give me your axe, Maud!
The sprites are coming! Give it to me! Pain, greater than I'd ever known, touched my face, my hands, my ribs. I felt something shift, and then an oppressive weight found my chest.
Come on!
A man's voice shouted. My mouth was pulled open by an unseen force, hot, torrid breaths filling me.
Breathe, diviner!
There were more sobs.
Bartholomew always wakes. Why doesn't she wake?
A woman's voice sounded.
Rory, no.
There was more pressure, a pounding sensation over my chest, so violent, the world quaked.
Wake up, sweetheart. Wake up.
And the pain I knew so well from drowning, from dreaming, was now the pain of awakening. I opened my eyes under a new shroud. Gossamer, fastened too loosely, lay over my eyes. When I peered through it, it was into a darkened room with high ceilings and a tall lancet window that held the night sky. I wore a long linen tunic and lay in a bed with a pillow and sheets far finer than the ones I'd been afforded at the diviner's cottage. I tried to move, to take in the anatomy of the room. But every muscle hurt, and half my bones were arrested in pain. There was a throbbing agony near my temple, and another along my left hip. But nothing was so painful as my stiff, bandaged neck.
Hello?
My voice grated up my throat.
Gargoyle?
No answer. I sat up. There was red on my linen tunic, too, below my pubis. I'd bled my moon's blood. I'd been lying there some time then. The world was hazy, my mind undulating. I remembered the darkness, hands tying fabric around my bleeding neck, then travelling through gales of wind, held in the gargoyle's stone arms. I was adrift, my body washed and bandaged and put in new clothes. Then, fitful sleep. It was all so murky. The last clear thing I recalled. I sat up. The ardent oarsman, his magic oar calling up waves, water crashing into me, teeth biting, blood, pain. She came barely a week ago, naked and still. I took her into my castle, placed her upon my throne. My body seized. Dead. Your diviners are all dead. I leaned over and coughed up bile. Then I was out of my bed, feet slapping against the cold floor. No fire was lit, the room a dark blotch behind my new shroud. I reached for the iron handle of my door, turned it, and was confronted by a long, twisting corridor with a wine-red carpet that ran down its center like a tongue. It looked like Ashling. Its ceilings were tall, vaulted, crafted with carefully cut stone. But the cathedral was unadorned but for its ancient pews, its stained glass windows. And this, wherever this was opulent in its ornaments. There were looking glasses taller than me and twice as wide. Tapestries, paintings, landscapes and portraits that, even in the hazy dimness, were vivacious in colour. Shelves upon shelves held tomes and glass casings filled with petrified insects, animal pelts, live plants with serpentine stems and black petals I didn't know the name of. Artistry, craftsmanship, everywhere. A low creak sounded somewhere ahead, and I limped toward it. When I reached the end of the corridor, I was greeted by three doors. I don't know what made me knock on the third door, or why, when no one answered it, I opened it. Hinges groaning, I was confronted by a wide room, lit by moonlight and the dying embers in a hearth. I stepped inside, throwing shadows hither and yon. The room was as the corridor, cluttered with artifacts. I saw a table, strewn with stacks of paper, some aged, some new. Hello? No one answered. I came to the desk, looking for a seal, some indicator of where I might be. The harried scribe's stone inkwell was there. My stomach twisted. So was the ardent oarsman's oar. I ignored both, my fingers scraping over parchment, stirring dust. There were leaflets, letters, and... my breath stilled. Benji's grandfather's notebook. A more obedient version of me would have left it alone. It wasn't mine to look at. But that version of me belonged to Ashling Cathedral, and I had fled that place, intruding upon the strange, perilous land of Traum. What was one more trespass? I opened it, the smells of aged leather and parchment filling my nose. I didn't know what I was looking for. Something to challenge the horrible things the ardent oarsman had spewed before his death. Proof of diviner's past. Reassurance in all of King Castor's scholarly learnings that daughters of Ashling had never been treated as anything but holy. I saw his art instead. Beautiful drawings, some in dark ink, others in faded colour. He'd drawn sprites, a few I recognised, many I didn't. Some looked like monsters, twisted bodies, hollowed out eyes, jagged teeth and claws, while others were strange amalgamations of birds and reptiles and mammals. He'd drawn gargoyles too, the details striking, particularly their wide stone eyes. Beneath them, in slanted script, was writ, "The gargoyle sprite has no discernible home, save the Tor, for their bodies are composed of the same limestone as the spring in which the diviners dream." I shoved the page aside, accosted by maps, dozens of them, with scribbles in the margins. King Castor had charted all the hamlets, and I could make out the rows of merchant tents at Coulson Fair, the cobbled streets and reaching buildings of the siege, the jagged contours of the fervent peaks. There was faded yellow paint where he'd painted the birch trees of the Chiming Wood, and pink where he'd rendered the dawn, rising over the sea along the cliffs of Belladine. Then, near the end of the notebook, a cathedral atop a hill. A long stone wall, and six shrouded figures. I leaned in, traced a finger over the ink. The art was faded, but I knew exactly who the six figures were. They weren't omens, they were diviners. Above each of them, drawn in careful detail, was a moth. King Castor's slanted script returned. "I have travelled Traum, this land we have settled into, the Stone Water Kingdom. Known her hamlets like the fingers of my hand, yet I have never met a diviner after her service at Ashling Cathedral has passed. There are no records of them in the Siege Libraries, no mention